As the meeting with Tordale draws closer, though, it squeezes out everything else. No more lunches, no staying up late, reading philosophy. We are in the office till the small hours, making calls, talking to the number crunchers, pulling together every available scrap of information on the Irish banking system. Most of our meetings are pedestrian affairs, quibbling over financial models with pension managers, fund managers, treasury people. This is different. The Caliphate's fund is worth several billion dollars. The day before the presentation, Rachel calls me to her office and promises me a guaranteed bonus if Tordale signs up with BOT. The figure she names is astronomical. She makes it sound like a threat. These guys are not messing around. Howie, who finds most of our work laughably dull, has taken an interest in this particular encounter. They're averaging a 13% annual return on a fund bigger than some country's GDP. You need to go into that conference room and slaughter them. You need to literally take your figures and stab them in the eyes with them. And when they scream, reach down their throats and yank out their hearts. Then you can start talking. Where will we put the bodies, Howie? I'm not kidding. I know these types of guys. They're cannibals. They're not going to hire the team with the nicest biscuits. I am in the gym at 5 the next morning, trying to work off some of my nervous energy. Ish arrives at 6:30 with her hair newly and spectacularly blonded. For the next couple of hours, we swivel in our chairs, drink endless coffee, leaf unseeingly through documents like students before a final exam. I'm talking to Brent Crude Kelleher, trying to get a read on the latest shifts in the oil market when there is a groan. A group of analysts is gathered in front of the TV where the German Chancellor is making an announcement. Even without hearing her, I can tell the news is bad. Look at that fucking face, Dwayne McGuckian says. She looks like she just ate a bag of dicks. It had been hoped that at the latest summit, Germany, as the only country in Europe with any money, would come forward with a plan to stabilize the teetering banks and the increasingly rickety-looking governments holding them up. Instead, the Chancellor is giving a lecture on responsibility. Committed as we are to the European project, we cannot endorse reckless fiscal behavior. Switch it off, Gary McCrum says. Spread's already gone up half a point. Jocelyn Lockhart reads off his terminal. Scheiße, Jürgen mutters. What's going on? Kevin says, arriving on the scene. Ish explains that Germany is refusing to step in to cover the losses of the weaker nations. Even before the press conference has ended, the amount of interest investors are demanding before they'll lend any more money to Ireland has jumped. Some of the ratings agencies are now publicly doubting the country will be able to pay its bills for much longer. What happens then, if it can't pay its bills? Someone else takes over. Probably someone with a German accent.
Maybe they could send him a few slave girls, Kevin says, till they get the accounts sorted out.
No one laughs. This is not good news. Not even a high-risk investor wants to put his money in a country about to go belly up. 11 o'clock comes and goes with no word from Tordale. Ish sits tentatively prodding her hair as if it were a wild and unpredictable animal. Jürgen paces up and down, flipping a pen between his fingers. Kevin alone is oblivious, calculating in a spreadsheet what he might do with his bonus.
We'll be promoted, he tells me. You should go for MD.
Losing patience, I'm about to snap that they aren't coming when Kimberly rings through from reception to say they've just arrived. 10 minutes later, they are on their way down from Rachel's office. We put on our best smiles. I had imagined the fund would be staffed by Arabs, but the four men who step out of the lift are white and English. The eldest is maybe 25. The others are barely more than boys. Slight-framed, tender-skinned, with their braces and slicked-back hair, they resemble corporate hobbits on their way to do a deal with Sauron. Their eyes are bloodshot and their faces pale, and one of them has skinned the knuckles on his right hand. The leader introduces himself as James Harper. The others, who all seem to be called Ollie, eye-ish and nudge each other. Rachel's expression as she hands them over to us is unreadable. Jürgen takes the party to the meeting room. The delegation doesn't reply to his questions with anything more than monosyllables. Their suits reek of cigarette smoke, and I can see a murky brown sweat line wringing the collar of the boy walking ahead of me. "You had a chance to see the city yesterday?" I ask him when he catches me looking. He turns away again and says loudly, "This bloke wants to know if we saw the city yesterday." The other three emit low, lurchy laughter. "We saw a bit of it," he says to me with a leer.
"You boys have been on the tear, as we are saying here in Ireland," Jürgen says. "Maybe you are drinking a few Guinnesses."
Ish shoots me a look that says, "We are doomed." In the conference room, we're joined by Chris Kane from sales, who makes a brief speech about Bank of Torabundo punching above its weight post-crash, adding that as our new CEO is a good friend of the Caliph's, he looks forward to BOT and Tordale becoming friends too. Then we crack open our laptops and begin the presentation, a concise but forensic breakdown of the major and minor Irish banks and their prospects in this volatile environment. The visitors aren't listening. They fiddle with their Blackberries, they smirk into space. It's only when one of his team actually falls asleep and starts to snore that James Harper confesses, though this is not quite the right word as his tone is more smug than contrite, that they didn't get much sleep. "The lads from Danske Bank took us out for a pint last night," he says, "though it ended up being a lot more than one." He hooks an extremely expensive leather brogue over his knee and draws himself back in a yawn. "Those boys know how to have fun," he says.
"But do they know how free cash flow will bear on future share performance?" Jürgen asks.
I lean over to Kevin and mutter in his ear, "Get Howie."
"What's the difference between a dead prostitute and a Ferrari? Did you hear about the Irish prostitute? What do you call a prostitute on a fishing expedition?" Around the table, shiny pink faces grin at us. Howie snaps his fingers at the waitress. A minute later, a fresh tray of lagers with single malt chasers appears. "Now that's the kind of woman I would like to have dead in my garage," Howie says as the waitress walks away. We are in Life Bar, treating the Londoners to hair of the dog. I am not used to drinking this early in the day, and already the room is swimming slightly. The Tordale delegation, however, look decidedly more lively. "Now I'll tell you who you don't want near your kids," Howie says, and proceeds to give a libellous but extremely well-informed account of a British cabinet minister's private activities. Kevin gazes at him with naked adoration. James Harper punches him matily on the arm. The room revolves on its hitherto unused axis. No one has mentioned caliphs, banks, or investment opportunities since the presentation. What time is it? 3? 4? Ish's face has taken on a greenish look, either from the whiskey or the prostitute jokes. More of both keep arriving like gatecrashers to an already oversubscribed house party, as well as a man Howie refers to only as the Bulgarian, who has made 2 visits to our table, on both occasions performing an elaborate handshake with the trader and then leaving again without taking off his sunglasses. On the way to the bathroom, I notice the floor canting to the left as though tipping me towards the exit. Inside, I find Howie and James Harper huddled in conversation by the cubicle doors. As soon as they see me come in, they break apart. "God!" Howie exclaims, as if I am a long-lost friend or any kind of friend. "I was just telling James about you. This guy," turning to James, "is the best wingman you'll ever have." "Oh, yeah?" James squints at me skeptically. "Women go crazy for him, because he's French, see? They're light years ahead of us over there in France. They actually teach you how to eat pussy in school." "That's exactly the kind of thing they ought to be doing in England," James Harper says seriously, regarding me now with a certain amount of appreciation. "Claude, we're thinking about going somewhere a bit more lively. What do you say? How about VDs? My heart sinks. "Fantastic," I say. "Jimbo, why don't you go round up your troops and we'll get a taxi," Howie says. When the Londoner is gone, he puts his arm around my shoulder and leans into me. It seems I can feel heat blasting from his face. "We're going to nail these bitches, Claude," he says in a low voice.
We're going to rape them and cut off their heads and bury them in the forest.
Very good, I say uncertainly. Do a line. It'll keep you sharp. Do it.
He commands, shuttling powder out onto the cistern.
Now, as I walk back, the floor is trying to flip me up towards the ceiling. But I am too smart for it. How brilliant and talented I am. Of course this deal is going to come off. There is no way anyone could resist our intelligence and charm. I put on my coat, wink at one of the hobbits, but as soon as the door opens, everything begins to slide again. Outside? Do we really have to go outside? Outside is not inside. A rash of oily sweat breaks out on my forehead. Fresh panics crowd in on the initial outside-inside scare. Harry couldn't actually be planning to rape and murder the Caliphate's sovereign wealth fund, could he? Sometimes with traitors it's hard to tell. People are hurrying back and forth across the plaza with their briefcases and box files. We step between their grey and substantial bodies as if through a sea of wraiths. The sounds of the city, the sky, the river, all of these things seem at one remove.
You've got these twants too, have you?
James Harper flicks a hand at the sagging tents and wayward signage of the zombies encamped outside Royal Irish. They're all over the square mile, fucking waste of space. Putting his hands together, he bellows at them.
No one cares, you twants!
Chris Kane grabs my arm.
This is going great, he mutters. Those pie charts really got their attention.
I grin back at him as one might at a figment of one's imagination one doesn't want to offend. The hobbit beside me elbows my ribs.
10 o'clock, mate,
he says. I turn my head, my all-purpose false grin at the ready, and then see he is pointing to the window of the Ark where Ariadne is on her hands and knees cleaning up a spill and inadvertently revealing most of her cleavage. The hobbit launches into an impressively comprehensive list of things he would like to do to Ariadne. I pretend I have not heard, step quickly ahead to the curb. Glowing yellow roof signs swim like radioactive clots down the artery of the traffic. Howie holds out a hand, and one cab, then a second, pulls up to us.
Why don't you ride with these two boys?
Howie suggests to Ish, nodding to the two younger delegates who gaze out of the cab's dark interior like baby owls.
Actually, I thought I might head home, Ish says.
Howie is dumbfounded.
What?
You're going to VD's, Ish protests. You don't want me there. I'd be cramping your style.
Gripping her shoulder, Howie takes her aside and hisses to her.
That's the whole point. We've got Gash coming to the club with us. That's what makes us cool and Danska squares.
Gash, Ish repeats.
Do I have to tell you your job? Just get in the car. When you get home, you can wipe the tears away with your big fat fucking bonus.
With her mouth tight shut, Ish climbs into the back of the cab.
I will ride in this car too,
Jürgen says judiciously and goes to the passenger door. The rest of us set off in the other taxi. Traffic is heavy. We move at a crawl past sparkling new office blocks, others barely begun, cranes that have not moved an inch in 2 years.
So 3 years ago, this was the third richest country on the planet,
James Harper observes.
And now it's fucked.
Property bubble, Howie says. Crash the banks.
They did naturally crash,
Chris Kane interjects hurriedly.
The minister guaranteed them. I heard about that,
James Harper says.
Not just the deposits, right? He said they cover every fucking bond and loan and dodgy deal with the Russian mafia the banks was into. Why do you do that, then?
Howie shrugs. Stupidity.
The banks lied to him, I qualify, about the size of their debts.
And now Paddy's got to pay for it and the whole place is in the shitter just like Greece.
It's different,
Howie counters.
The Irish aren't going to cause trouble. They'll do what they're told. Anyway, the problem here is the banks. In Greece, the problem is Greece.
Yeah, but your minister made the banks in Ireland the same thing, ain't he? With his magic fucking wand of incompetence.
Howie shakes his head.
Greece is finished. This place will recover. In the meantime, there is a lot of money to be made. It's a national fire sale. You can get the whole water grid for half nothing. What's that going to be worth in 20 years?
Walter's been pushing us to get into Royal Irish,
James Harper is silent for a moment. Howie glances at me. Don't know that that's the first call I'd make. Word is they're sitting on a black hole. Don't tell Walter that, James Harper says. He's in him up to his tits. I turn in my seat. It is very important at a meeting like this never to show your ignorance. But in many conversations with Walter Corliss, I have never heard him mention Royal Irish, let alone seen any of their stock in his portfolio. Is he keeping secrets? Or is James Harper simply misinformed? Howie is telling him about other investment possibilities, retail banks with 1 million depositors available for 2 or 3% of what they were worth 2 years ago, but the Londoner is hard to impress. We've heard all the hard luck stories. Every sodding bank in Europe's been over looking for a few quid from the gaffer, most of the Yanks as well. But he could do very well out of it. Real estate too. Howie gestures out the window at the pristine rows of empty buildings. What is it they say? When there is blood on the streets, buy property.
Don't tell me about blood on the streets, mate, James Harper says. Iran, you put on a bulletproof vest before you get off the plane.
I turn again. I thought the unrest hadn't reached Iran.
They keep it out of the papers, don't they? But the last time I was over there, they'd hanged a load of revolutionaries across the road from my hotel. 11 geezers lined up along the street like we are fucking dead FC. Fucking dogs barking all night trying to chew their shoes off.
Terrorists?
Some bunch of raggers coming out of the desert. You know, the type, Quran in one hand, AK in the other, making a big bleeding hullabaloo that the caliph's a blasphemer and not a proper caliph and all that.
But he's got things under control. He's got nothing to worry about.
Seeing his bleeding Imperial Guard, 50 fucking sand niggers 7 foot tall that can kill a man with one blow, he's all right. It's every other cunt who's shitting it.
He shifts his weight, making his buttocks squeak against the vinyl. Once Walter's got this wall finished, it'll be easier. Hopefully the gaffer will keep a lid on things till then. As he speaks, we pull up at our destination. The suddenly sombre mood is lifted by the other Tordale delegates, who haul their leader from the cab with the happy news that they mooned a policeman en route. James Harper brightens immediately. Two bald, puffer-jacketed sentinels are guarding a stairwell. Over their heads, a neon sign spells out Velvet Dreams. A deep, pulmonary thrum issues from the subterranean entrance. The four brilliantined visitors hasten boisterously down the steps towards it. Following after them, Ish momentarily catches my eye. I give her a sympathetic pat on the elbow. At the door, we are met by a svelte girl wearing a kind of heart-shaped velvet bustier that covers half of her breasts and some legal minimum of her genitals. She leads us to a table. Chris Kane conspicuously passes her a credit card, and our guests, as if at a signal, start shouting drink orders. Around us, girls glide constantly through the red-tinged murk. Some carry trays of drinks, others plastic gourds, which they shake like tambourines, soliciting tips for the dancers, others carrying nothing at all but bend in close to the men on the banquettes and whisper in their ears. Now and then one will get to his feet, as if he's been fingered by the thought police, and be led away into the darkness. At the top of the room is a stage where a girl with long blonde hair and enormous, unreal breasts is spinning around a pole in metallic hot pants. As she pivots faster and faster, hair and pants become interweaving rings of light like some electrical phenomenon.
Busy, Chris Kane observes. Recession-proof, innit?
One of the hobbits says.
People always want to watch a fit bird get her ganny out, good times and bad. Structurally, sex industry's very robust.
Another hobbit agrees.
Look at the flaming structure on that.
The third hobbit says, nodding at a statuesque girl in a thong who has arrived at our table. Her vampish maquillage and stupendous bosom cannot quite counteract a callow bumpkin quality. Perhaps it is in the way she stands, her shoulders squared as if ready to carry a hay bale.
You want private dance?
She inquires. The Tordale delegation crack up.
You what, darling? Private dance?
The girl repeats, shifting uncertainly. Ersatz gemstones glitter blankly from her thong.
A privet dance?
You got a musical bush, love?
She is blushing now, the colour visible even in the degraded light.
Only teasing you, sweetheart.
The youngest hobbit pats her hand.
I'd love a dance.
The girl smiles uncertainly and performs a clumsy backstep as the hobbit gets to his feet. Chris Kane hurriedly passes him the credit card. The hobbit takes it without even looking at him. As she leads him away, he gives his comrades a rascally grin.
I'm going to put a great big dent in her privates.
No touching, mate,
his colleague reminds him.
Remember Birmingham!
Howie and James Harper are at one end of the banquette, deep in talk. Jürgen begins telling us how many Weissbiers on the market are, strictly speaking, not Weissbiers. One of the hobbits slides over to Ish.
All right,
he says. A famous banker once said that the key to gaining a client is to become his friend. People give their business to people they like. In banking, where what we actually do with the money becomes ever harder to explain, indeed, where a client half expects his own bank to rip him off, a strong bond between you and your account is paramount. Hence the fortune spent on entertaining, the rugby matches and Grand Prix and golf tournaments, the lavish dinners and premier cru and trips to Venice, the girls who appear at the door of your client's hotel bedroom at 2 a.m. just in case he needs anything. Obviously, the system turned into a racket long ago. Nowadays, the best salesman is the one who can make his client believe that he is his friend in spite of the ostentatious gifts and luxuries he bears. For me, this has always been a lie too far. At these events, I usually limit myself to making sure the glasses stay full. Looking for a waitress, I see that a fresh dancer has come on stage. She has long dark hair and a tawny complexion and looks enough like Ariadne that I experience a pang. As she cavorts naked around the pole, I clothe her in a black Airtex t-shirt and jeans, give her a tray and a smile and a smudge of cinnamon on her apron. Then something else catches my eye. A silhouette at one of the tables girdling the stage. I stare at it without knowing why. Then I realize who it belongs to. Excuse me for one moment, I say to our guests. He is alone, gazing up at the stage, so fixed on the dancer's performance he doesn't notice me until I tap his shoulder. He turns. I see the drowsy swim and swoon of his pupils as his eyes attempt to focus. Then recognition dawns at last and an expression of horror crosses his face. He springs, or rather staggers, to his feet, staying upright only for a moment before falling backwards over his stool, from which position he warns me not to try anything.
I am not going to try anything, I say. That's good,
Paul says, pulling himself back onto his stool.
For you.
He lifts a shot glass from the table and brings it to his lips, not seeming to notice that it is empty. The dancer smacks her buttock, leaving a bright pink handprint glowing on her skin. What are you doing here? I ask him.
What are you doing here?
He retorts, eyes trained on the dancer who has stalked over to the end of the stage so that another solitary spectator can tuck a note into her G-string, which has evidently remained on for that purpose.
If you're looking for an apology, you're wasting your time.
I'm not looking for an apology.
Oh, you want to have me arrested, is that it? Well, go right ahead. There's not a judge in the land who'd convict me. They'd probably give me a medal.
I don't want to have you arrested.
Well, what do you want, so?
I am at a loss. I came over on impulse without thinking why. Only now does it occur to me that we have nothing to say to one another. On stage, the dancer shucks down her knickers to reveal a finger of carefully trimmed pubic hair, then reaches between her legs to spread her labia. To a rising chorus of hoots, wolf whistles, catcalls, she slowly begins to arch her torso backwards. Was it always a scam? I hear myself say.
What?
He says irritably. The book. Your book. Did you ever intend to write it? Even as I speak the words, I know the question is futile, irrelevant, like asking the person breaking up with you whether they ever really loved you. Paul looks up at me, suitably disgusted.
Seriously?
I thought maybe in the beginning. He waves a hand, cutting me off.
I don't do that shit anymore,
he says.
What
Shit, I say. You mean writing? Paul shrugs, returns his attention to the floor show. Inch by inch, thighs quivering, the dancer has bent back so that her dark hair sweeps the floor and the spotlight shines directly athwart the sad little heart she holds between her fingers. From behind, the noise of the unseen crowd breaks over us, cheers and applause as if the vagina were a famous diva hitting a high C. You don't write at all? Paul casts about him and signals to a passing girl, pale with a mane of chestnut hair.
Private dance?
She says, coming over.
I have to go,
he says to me.
Wait!
I reach out, grab his arm.
Why me?
I say. Paul looks back at me with a mixture of pity and guilt and exhaustion.
I have to go,
he says again. I release him. The chestnut-haired girl takes his hand. I watch him follow her away towards the honeycomb of rooms at the back. On stage, the dancer takes a bow. A moment later, a dolorous attendant trudges out with a spray and a flannel, with which he wipes down the pole and the dance floor.
There he is!
One of the hobbits grabs me in a loose headlock as I slide back into our table.
You horny little fucker! I thought you was going to crawl right up that bird's minge!
I smile, take a sip from my repulsive fluorescent drink, and put the encounter out of my mind. Glancing around the table, I gauge our progress. The smallest and most earnest hobbit is speaking animatedly to Chris Kane, whose face exhibits the mixture of fascination and panic, characteristic of one whose efforts to feign interest are undermined by his inability to hear what's being said. The burly boy who put me in a headlock rambles to Jürgen and Kevin about football. His curly-haired colleague, now wearing his tie wrapped around his head Rambo style, is talking to Ish in a low, intense voice that requires her to lean ever closer. Of Howie and James Harper there is no sign, but I spot Howie's Bulgarian friend from earlier moving through the crowd in the direction of the toilets. That is where the deal will happen, if there is one. Our job now is to run interference, keep the others happy so Howie can work uninterrupted. I order a fresh round of drinks, take a surreptitious look at my watch. The next dancer has come on. A synthetic blonde with breasts like warheads who humps the pole slowly and then, as if at the flick of a switch, at double speed. Her siliconized body and its clumsy imitations of love put me in mind of an early iteration of a new technology, those first oxymoronic mobile phones the size and weight of breeze blocks.
So,
with a suddenly businesslike air, the burly boy now places his elbows on the table and leans in.
BOT's based in Dublin a good while now.
Almost 10 years,
Jürgen says.
The regulatory climate here gives our clients many options not available to London banks.
10 years?
The burly boy considers.
And in that time?
He looks around at each of us in turn.
Have you ever seen a leprechaun?
Hilarity engulfs the visiting party. Their faces are rubicund and sloppy with drink, and looking at them, I have the incontrovertible certainty, as if it were inscribed over the scene, like the motto of a Hogarth print, that we are being taken for a ride. And then a shadow falls across the table. A girl is standing there, a black girl, easily 6 foot tall, lithe and muscular, and making no pretense of affability. Private dance, she says. She pronounces it like a death sentence. The visitors look at each other. We look at them looking at each other. Chris Kane readies the credit card.
You get off with her,
the curly-haired boy says. It takes a moment for Ish to realize he is talking to her.
Excuse me?
He nods up at the lap dancer.
Go on, give her a snog,
he says. Ish, for once, is speechless. She stares back at him agape.
Why not? She's gorgeous!
He persists.
You've been giving me the brush off all night. Maybe this bird's more your flavour. Come on, I'll pay!
He reaches into his jacket pocket and takes out his wallet. From the fold, he removes a wad of bills and counts them out onto the table. Ish turns to Jürgen, but he sits there as if frozen, grinning glassily at thin air.
Go on, go on!
The boy's comrades urge Ish, laughing. The lap dancer waits motionlessly at the table side, her face utterly blank.
Fuck off, Ish says.
The other two make mock appalled ooh sounds, but the curly-haired boy is undaunted.
I'm not saying you have to lick her out, just give her a kiss. How much to kiss her with tongues?
This latter is directed at the lap dancer.
Come on, don't be an old biddy!
The burly boy joshes Ish.
Walter told us you lads knew how to have a laugh!
I get to my feet. I am afraid we have another appointment. Jürgen's eyes flash at me from the banquette. I ignore them, reach for Ish's hand, which she gives me dazedly, though she remains in her seat.
Wait!
The curly-haired boy says. He has stopped laughing. The others stop too and look at him. He licks his lips and says slowly to Ish,
if you get off with her, we'll sign with BOT. Over our table, in the midst of the thudding music and the barracking laughter, a dome of silence falls. Ish hunches miserably in her chair. Jürgen carefully examines his cufflinks. Kevin gawps as if he's watching the Wimbledon final. And the lap dancer continues to look on, impassive as a Japanese mask. Then some kind of fracas starts up at the top of the room. A man and a woman shouting. Everyone turns to look. I take advantage of the distraction to tug Ish to her feet and drag her away. She appears conflicted. At the door, she turns to me.
Maybe.
Go, I say, hustling her up the stairs. The shouting voices get louder. Craning my neck as I make my way through the crowd, I can see the chestnut-haired girl from earlier berating a punter. His back is turned, but there is no doubt who it is. A bouncer storms past me to intervene. I find myself hurrying after him.
What's going on?
The bouncer demands.
He take my money!
The dancer says accusingly.
I didn't!
Paul protests.
You take!
It was a simple misunderstanding,
Paul says to the bouncer.
I no misunderstand!
The dancer counters in a voice like a circular saw.
I understand very well. This man is thief!
Would you just let me explain? What happened was, I wanted to tip her, but I only had a 20. So I put the 20 in her G-string and then I took out a 10 as change.
He take my money!
As change. What, I can't take change?
Right, mate, you're out.
The bouncer says.
But I'm a regular!
Paul cries.
I have a loyalty card!
This does not sway the bouncer, who twists his arm behind his back and shoves him down a gauntlet of jeering drinkers towards the exit. I give chase, reaching street level just in time to see Paul propelled over the asphalt to land in a heap on the curb opposite.
You're barred!
The bouncer shouts after him. Crossing the road, I help him sit up. Are you all right?
Oh, sure.
He examines his front teeth with a finger and thumb.
They say you're barred, but then in a week they've forgotten all about it.
By the stairwell, the bouncer is laughing with his cronies. Now they step aside to allow in a stag party. So this is what you do instead of writing, I say.
When I can afford it.
Paul replies tersely. He drags himself to his feet and spits. I think that is a great shame, I say.
You're one of a very small number.
He takes his wallet from his pocket, peers into it fatalistically, then replaces it.
You never answered my question.
What question?
Why did you pick me for your plan?
He shrugs, looks away.
I told you before, you were different. You had qualities.
What qualities?
Loneliness. Desperation.
This stings. To cover it up, I spit out another question.
And the book? Did you ever intend to write it?
Oh, Jesus, Claude, what does it matter?
He exclaims, jumping to his feet.
Okay, I never intended to write a book. Happy?
I don't reply. Look down at the cracked asphalt instead.
And I'll tell you what else. If I did through some calamity start a new book, I wouldn't write about you and your friends in 100 years. A bunch of people with one character attribute between them. Mr. Greedy, Mr. Greedy, Mr. Greedy, and Mr. Greedy. Like something out of Roger Hargreaves' nightmares. Who's going to want to read about that?
He stares at me with blazing eyes as if expecting an answer. I say nothing. I feel a huge rent has been slashed in the canvas of my soul and blackness is billowing out.
Look,
he says, maybe regretting his candor.
You're not the worst of them. I'm sorry I did this to you, but my God, man.
You don't even live in the world. You don't breathe the air. You don't eat the food. You're up in some strange little satellite placing bets on all of us down below like kids racing beetles. How could you think, how did you ever possibly think that you were an everyman?
I can't speak. What can I possibly say? Paul waits a moment with his hand on my shoulder, and then he turns and walks away, leaving me in the shadow of the club, from which the music boomed so loud that even out on the street I experience it not in my ears but in my chest, pounding between my ribs like someone else's heart. I meet Chris Kane in the gym the next morning. He tells me that he stayed out with the Tordell team till 3. He appears aglow with health in spite of his long, debauched night and minimal sleep. This is often the way with my banking colleagues. Even the older men, as though they had a picture of themselves mouldering in the attic, or more likely these days, had outsourced the disintegration of their bodies to some proxy in the third world, some Manuel or Cho or Pradeep, who wakes up one day with shattered capillaries, clogged lungs, a fissiparous liver, that are none of his doing.
Great bunch of lads, Chris Kane says, and then, I just hope Ish didn't damage her chances.
That guy was out of line.
He wasn't serious. Fuck's sake. You have to show you're able to take a joke.
Upstairs, Ish is already at her desk. I can feel the resentment directed at her from around the room, as can she, to judge by her posture, crouched behind her terminal.
Thanks, Claude, she says in a low voice when she sees me.
Thanks for what?
For sticking up for me.
I blush as our pusillanimous show comes back to me. If Tordell were testing our moral fibre, though they almost definitely weren't, we failed with flying colours.
What a night, he says.
Just business.
I'll bet Rachel's bullying.
They never intended to take us on.
Howie said they did. Howie said that when we were having our argument, he was in the jacks doing rails with the main guy, and the main guy started telling him he was thinking of leaving his wife.
So?
He said it showed we'd got to the next level. It didn't show anything. They're not going to take us on. They won't take on Danska either. They came here to drink, that's all.
I find Jürgen standing at the window, peering out at the zombies with his binoculars. They are just beginning to stir. One heats a saucepan of water on a gas burner. Another eats a bowl of cereal in the opening of his tent. They are not wearing their costumes yet. You can see how young they are.
Have we heard anything? I say, keeping my tone neutral.
They will revert to us by the end of the week.
He replies in the same clipped, mechanical tone. A pretty girl with a heap of tousled brown hair emerges from a tent and turns on a string of fairy lights. Adjusting his focus wheel, Jürgen says,
You have completed your report on Royal?
It's not due for 2 more weeks.
That is not what I asked you.
No, it's not finished, I say, and then feeling rebellious. But I can tell you now that I would not recommend Royal Irish to any client. Jürgen says nothing to this, just continues to stare out. I am about to step away, then I stop. What happened last night? I say.
Yes?
We are supposed to be a team.
Yes, we are supposed to be a team.
He returns. A team looks after its members. He remains silent, stares out at the zombies. Then he says,
A team exists to achieve goals. If there were no goals, there would be no team. Therefore, goals take priority over members. And members who do not achieve the team's goals will be replaced.
The report is going slowly, very slowly. Financial institutions are chimerical creatures at the best of times, but Royal's books are like nothing I've ever seen. Every figure is a door into a world of illusion, of shape-shifting, duplication, disappearing acts. Deals are buried or recorded more than once. Borrowers are split into two or lumped together. Mysterious sums arrive and depart without explanation, like ships full of toxic waste that pull into a harbor in the middle of the night and the next day are gone again. Royal Irish. The name sounds like a bad poker hand, one that looks unbeatable until it capsizes and you lose your shirt. After everything that's happened, it's something hard to remember that until quite recently, it did look unbeatable. When I first arrived at BOT, only a couple of years ago, Royal was being described as the best bank in the world. Across the ocean, the subprime market was just beginning to turn, but Ireland was still booming. Coming from Paris, which for several years had been in the doldrums, I felt like I had stepped through the looking glass. Every day was like Christmas Eve. The shops, the pubs, the restaurants were all full, all of the time. In the beginning, the boom was fueled by IT and pharmaceuticals. Now it was construction. Dublin was undergoing its very own housemanization. Cranes cluttered the skyline. New builds were everywhere. The old architecture, meanwhile, was being transformed. Hospitals becoming shopping malls. Churches becoming super pubs. Ascendancy manors becoming five-star golf resorts. And at the heart of all of it was Royal. They were the developer's bank of choice, spinning out the credit from which the new city would be built. In the fevered boomtown climate, the value of property could double every 6 months. Already, several of these developers had become billionaires, but they didn't rest on their laurels. Instead, they used what they'd made on their last project to borrow more for their next one. Royal were happy to pay out. They had a steady stream of cheap credit from European investors, eager to gain exposure to the turbocharged Irish economy. Only Bank of Torabundo stayed away. Our chief executive, Sir Colin Shred, was deeply skeptical about Royal. He thought they were over-invested in a single sector. He thought that sector was heading for a crash, but Royal's share price had risen astronomically, 2,000% in 7 years, and our clients were howling at the fortunes they were missing out on. It was clear to me within a few weeks of starting at BOT that if I could change Sir Colin's mind, many people would be grateful to me. I decided to set up a meeting with Royal CEO, Miles O'Connor, to talk through his figures and long-term strategy. But this proved far from easy. As head of the best bank in the world, Miles was a man much in demand. Businessmen and governments alike clamored to learn his secrets. He was flying all over the world, dispensing wisdom. I had almost given up hope when Bruce Gaffney, a salesman I knew at Royal, called to tell me that if I came to the Shelbourne Hotel that night, he could get me 5 minutes, no more. Royal's AGM had been that morning, and an air of jubilation filled the hotel lobby, along with wafts of cigar smoke that drifted in through the revolving doors. When he began at Royal, then an inconsequential boutique, Miles had targeted the rugby clubs both for staff and for clients. The atmosphere tonight was that of a locker room, loud with backslapping and her-her-herring. The waitresses were having a hard time. I spent what seemed like many hours on the margins of things, having the same desultory conversation about the French scrum over and over again. Any time I caught a glimpse of Miles, he was at the center of a cluster of men who hung on his every word like barfly apostles. Then, out of the blue, or had Bruce, unbeknownst to me, intervened, I found myself thrust up against him. I had not expected to like him, but I did. Moments after meeting me, the leader of one of the world's most successful banks was calling me a sound cunt and asking what I was drinking. After working in Paris, where everything was swamped in protocol and 23-year-old men conducted themselves like mouldering dukes, I found this refreshing, to say the least. He was slight, silver-haired, foxy, quite unlike the meaty second-row types he liked to surround himself with. He was smoking a fat cigar, which in the reception room of one of Dublin's oldest and costliest hotels was even more against the rules than it was elsewhere. He had a mischievous sense of humor. "Take a look, Claude," he said, pulling his phone from his pocket. "What do you make of this fella, eh?" I looked at the phone. On the screen was a picture of a glossy black stallion. "His name's Turbolot," Miles said. "We're thinking of appointing him to the board." His frank black eyes regarded mine. I gazed back at him dumbly. Slapping my stomach with the back of his hand, he hooted with laughter.
"Your face, Jesus Christ!"
He knew Sir Colin didn't care for him. He didn't seem to mind. Instead, he found it quite natural.
"He's a Brit. He hates to see the Paddies getting ahead. To him, that's the lunatics taking over the fucking asylum. But the tide has turned, Claude. That's what we need to accept. Do you know what we did last week? Bankrolled a consortium to buy the Chichester Hotel from the Duke of Edinburgh. The Irish are buying up the Queen's fucking back garden. Of course, the old guard don't like it."
"He thinks you've taken on too much risk," I told him. I realized that with him I could speak directly. "He thinks you've left yourself exposed if the market turns." Miles dismissed this with a wave of his cigar.
"Look, Claude, he's your boss. I don't want to speak ill of him, but Sir Colin's a fossil. He's the remnant of an empire that spent the last 100 fucking years slowly sinking into the sea. Ireland is different. It's small, it's young, it's versatile. And because in Ireland we're not wedded to a whole lot of empty protocol, we understand that when change happens, it's big and it's fast. There isn't time to run all your decisions past risk and treasury and whoever else. Your job is to get the money out to the fella who's going to use it ASAP, and there's the end to it. He doesn't want to be hassled by some prat with a diploma looking for fucking pie charts and breakdowns and all that. He wants to make something happen. He wants to do a fucking deal. Now the question is, are you going to help him?"
He looked me straight in the eye, smoke pumping from his mouth in industrial quantities, sweat beading on his brow, his bow tie slightly askew. "Listen," he said, "you're here to ask me how it all works. And I'm just going to tell you the truth, which is that I don't have the faintest fucking notion. Sometimes I feel like the dog that woke up with two Mickeys. I know it's a good thing, but I'm fucked if I know how it happened. I'll tell you this, though. The Irish have been everybody's bloody slave long enough. It used to be whenever I'd go to the airport, it'd be full of young people shipping off to Australia or New York for whatever gammy bit of work they could get. Now, when I go to the airport, I see them coming back, coming home, because they can have a better life here. I know it's all supposed to be about the bottom line, but I'm proud of that. I'm bloody proud. You'll have another?"
He pointed at the half-empty glass in my hand. Before I could reply, he had disappeared and a fresh pint materialized. It took me a moment to realize that was the end of the interview. But when I thought about it, what more analysis did I need? He was right, wasn't he? Maybe on paper the bank looked vulnerable. But that was only if you believed in the old way of doing things. The world was changing. Switch on the television, you saw ordinary people being turned into superstars overnight. Why shouldn't Miles and his developers do the same for Ireland? Why should they be weighed down by the relics of the past? History was being rolled back. Ancient oppressions undone. Did it matter if the bank's loan book outweighed its deposits?
To Sir Colin, it did. He rejected my request to issue a buy recommend for Royal. He declined to hear the presentation I'd put together. Later, I heard that was when the board of directors began to mass themselves against him. But of course he was right. Looking through Royal's loan book now is like swimming through a drowned world. The numerical ruins of hotels and houses, of malls and towers and temples, all buried under blue-tinged, airless fathoms of debt. The city is being sold off piece by piece for bargain basement rates, and the airports are full of people saying goodbye.
"You are ready to order?"
"Not yet, thank you. I am waiting for someone." I speak offhandedly without quite looking at her.
"Okay,"
Ariadne says gaily.
"Call when you want me."
I watch her glide away, divert her course at a raised finger, lavish her smile on two men in iron-gray suits who don't know quite what to do with it. Outside, a stream of ricocheting droplets hovers over the plaza. For the last week, the rain has been almost continuous. In the office, we have all become experts in its different personae and gradations. Can predict the worst of downpours, gauge the gaps that will allow us a coffee run. More than once, I have dreamed that the Ark has come unmoored and floated away with me in it.
Checking out the arses, eh?
I look up. Bruce Gaffney, my Royal Irish contact, is grinning down at me, emitting his familiar emphysemic dog laugh. He peels off his raincoat, parks himself across the table from me.
I wondered why you wanted to meet in this, Kip. Now I get it. How's tricks, Claudius? What can I do you for?
I tell him the government has commissioned a report from us on Royal. He issues a comical huff of exasperation.
Report?
He says.
They can't get enough of those things, can they?
The last recapitalization didn't work. You're running out of money faster than they can replace it. They're wondering if there's any point giving you more.
Well, if they don't want to see yours truly fed to the sharks by a bunch of very fucking unhappy bondholders, they'll keep the taps on.
He says,
you're French, Claude. You know the famous German bonhomie doesn't stretch all that far.
Ariadne returns with her order pad. I ask for two coffees. The instant she turns away, Bruce goes into a routine, boggling, winking, panting in fake agony. The point is, soon there won't be any money left to give you, I say, ignoring this. They can't raise those kinds of funds anymore.
Dark times, Claudius, dark times,
Bruce Gaffney says and shakes his head, as if I've been telling him about some other bank in some other country very, very far away.
Aha!
He brightens as Ariadne returns with our coffee.
The goddess of the grounds, the Beatrice of the bean, thank you, darling.
I try again. Can you survive without another recap?
What, nothing at all?
He says as if affronted, then, seeing my expression, changes tack.
What I mean is, we're almost over the hump. If we could get another, say, 7 billion, we'd definitely be able to hold our own until this all blows over.
You said that last time.
Yeah, but last time we should have said we needed 14 billion. I don't know where we got 7, frankly. Some trainee probably just made it up.
But, you see, I am struggling to keep my patience. That's exactly why they've asked me to write this report. They don't trust the figures you're giving them.
Right, right,
he says, his attention wandering across the plaza again. Then, as I open a folder and pass a spreadsheet over to him.
Ah, here, don't be dumping this stuff on me, not on a bloody Friday afternoon.
I just wanted to know if you can clarify some things. He rolls his eyes, presses his lips, as if I had brought him to lunch and then tried to sell him a watch. This figure here, do you know what it relates to?
What, off the top of my head?
It's 50 million euro.
I don't know, he says. Gandon?
Gandon is here. Whitcroft is here. Dreyer's, Gain International, all those are accounted for. But this money here, there's no indication where it's going. Instead, someone's tried to bury it by hiding it inside another transaction. Bruce Gaffney flicks his teeth with his fingers to produce the first two bars of La Marseillaise.
Must be one of those things then, mustn't it?
What things?
The things they have on aeroplanes that they dig up when it crashes. What do you call it? A black box.
A black box?
Yeah, a black box.
You are telling me nobody knows what this 50 million might relate to?
He shrugs, looks me full on. The plaza passes translucent in his glasses, veiling his eyes.
I'm trying to help you, I say.
Oh, Jesus. He throws up an exasperated hand. Maybe Miles took a few quid out to invest or something. It's a bank, Claude. It's a highly complicated fucking, you know, operation. I mean, are you going to put every single rubber fucking ban into this bloody report?
With so many irregularities, it will be hard to find a buyer.
Fine! Fuck the buyers, it'll sort itself out.
Like I've told you for the last 2 fucking years, what Royal has is a minor cash flow problem. The real issue is that we're being made the scapegoats. We're carrying the can for the whole country turn into shit. Well, fuck that, Claude. Fuck that. It's not like we went around putting a gun to people's heads and telling them to take out a second mortgage. Everybody partied. Now they're blaming us for their hangover.
The flare of temper is quickly damped down. He becomes affable again, solicitous. He leans in closer to the table. Look, I know the books are a bit of a mess. It's fucking Royal, what do you expect? But the fact of the matter is the place is sound. I'm in there every day. I can tell you with my hand on my heart, it's sound. Now, I know you're a straight shooter. I'm not going to tell you what to put in your report, but I would ask, as a colleague, that you give the full story. Don't be banging on exclusively about anomalies or black boxes or whatever the fucking secretary dropped behind the radiator. As he gets up, I ask him about Dublex.
What about Dublex?
He says, do they have a holding in Royal? This time his ignorance seems genuine.
First I've heard of it. Walter crawls out of his gravel pit the odd time for a round of golf with the board, but that's about the size of it.
Now a smile crosses his face.
Here, have you seen these lads dressed as zombies outside the new HQ? It's fucking classic. There's a zombie Miles and everything. This little lad with a silver wig and this suit covered in shit. Hilarious!
He pauses judiciously at the door.
See, that's the kind of protest they should have in Greece instead of chucking petrol bombs. They're making their point, but at the same time giving everyone a bit of a laugh. Fuck knows we could use one. Good to see you, Claude. If there's anything else I can do for you, you know where to ask.
He points at his bottom, then hurries,
fuck's sake,
back into the rain. I gather the documents, spread over the table, tap them straight, set them down again. There is nothing I can do that will make them make sense. They are not a black box, but a black hole, into which time, trust, meaning, other people's money disappear endlessly. Another coffee? Ariadne has reappeared at my shoulder. I smile stiffly. I should go back to work.
You can wait till the rain stops,
she says, and then,
hey, you want to try something?
Before I can reply, she has whisked away, and then whisked back again with a plate.
Baklava is my grandmother's recipe.
She hovers as I lift a forkful to my mouth. The cake is sweet and sticky with crunches of almond and cinnamon. It's hard to eat with her watching me, and also hard to swallow and speak. Nevertheless, I am able to declare mostly honestly that I like it.
My grandmother makes it much better. I think it's maybe the honey she used.
No, it's good, I say, taking another bite. Savoureux, as we say in France.
In Greek we say nostimo, which means something you want to come back to. You know, like nostalgia, the pain to want to return home.
She laughs.
That's Greece. You cannot even eat a cake without the past coming looking for you.
I smile. How green her eyes are and bright. Looking into them is like walking through an enchanted forest. It strikes me that I am alone with her. I feel an odd sense of unburdenment, as if we are two characters in a play meeting in the wings while the scenery is changed.
So you are from Greece?
I say, wincing internally at my accent, the dinosaur clump of the words.
What has made you come to Ireland? You watch the news?
It has not always been like this.
No, until this year we cover it up.
And you're from France?
Yes, I say. There is a pause. I realize in horror that I have exhausted my entire conversational repertoire.
And your friend too?
She nods at the empty seat. He is not my friend.
Not the man today, the other one, doesn't wear a suit, always in black.
Oh, him, no, he is Irish.
Why doesn't he come here anymore?
He lost his job.
Ah, that's a shame.
She appears genuinely dismayed.
I always like to see the two of you talking. It looked like you're coming up with a secret plan. I thought someday maybe you'd call me over and make me a part of it.
Okay, Ariadne, here's what we're gonna do.
We almost did, I say.
Well, if you ever make another, let me tell you I'm a very good person to be included.
Is that right? I say levelly, though I feel like I'm in a car that is spinning out of control.
Yes, because for a beginning, I can make special cake with magical powers of returning the past. I can paint the abstract paintings with magical powers of not selling, and I can use my Greekness to give the etymologies of many words. Very useful quality.
Give me an example. She draws herself up straight, knits her brows, takes a moment.
So, she says, this word psyche, that means your mind or your soul or your spirit. In Greece, in ancient times, psyche was the word for a butterfly. And in those times, they think when you are nervous about something or you feel something intensely, you have inside you a psyche. And then slowly, the meaning changed and a psyche becomes something immortal that is essential to you.
But that is how the idea of the soul began? From butterflies in your stomach?
Or you can look at it the other way around,
she says, fixing me in her green gaze.
You can say these moments when inside you is jumping, like when you're talking to somebody you like. That's how you know you have a soul.
And she smiles, and I smile, and her eyes glow at me, and with a flurry of heartbeats, I have the indescribable but irrefutable sense that I am back in the story again. Or that life and story have somehow come together in one impossibly fragile moment, like a psyche, a butterfly lighting on my palm.